Salt yields to none of these in usefulness, since it serves as the finishing touch that food receives on its way into the body, giving it a fitness suited to our appetite. But consider also whether this further divine quality belongs to it, that by keeping dead bodies free of decay and preserving them for a long time, it resists death itself and does not allow what is mortal to perish and vanish entirely. Just as the soul, the most divine part of us, holds living creatures together and does not let their substance dissolve, so the nature of salt, taking hold of dead bodies and imitating the work of the soul, checks them as they are being carried toward corruption, restrains and steadies them, and provides harmony and mutual affinity among their parts. That is also why some of the Stoics say that the flesh of a living pig is essentially dead meat, with the soul scattered through it, like salt, merely to keep it from spoiling. You see, too, that we consider the fire of a thunderbolt sacred and divine, because we observe that the bodies of those struck by it remain undecayed and endure for a long time. What wonder is it, then, if the ancients supposed salt divine as well, since it possesses the very same power as that divine fire? When I fell silent, Philinus took up the discussion. "Does the power of generation not seem divine to you," he said, "given that God rules over all things?" When I agreed, he said, "Well then, people believe that salt contributes not a little to generation, just as you yourself mentioned regarding the Egyptians. Those who breed dogs, at any rate, when the females prove too sluggish toward mating, arouse and stir their dormant sexual instinct with, among other things, salty food and salted meat. Ships that carry salt breed an enormous multitude of mice. Since, as some say, the females become pregnant even without mating, simply by licking the salt, though it is more likely that the saltiness produces an itching in their organs and so spurs the creatures on toward coupling. Perhaps that is also why people call a woman's beauty, when it is neither inert nor unpersuasive, but mixed with charm and allure, salty and piquant. I think, too, that the poets call Aphrodite seaborn, and put forward the myth invented about her origin from the sea, as a veiled reference to the generative power of salt. Indeed, they represent Poseidon himself, and the sea gods generally, as prolific and the fathers of many children. And among the animals themselves, you could not name any creature of land or air as prolific as the creatures of the sea are altogether. Which is what Empedocles had in mind when he wrote of the sea bearing the unmusical tribe of the widely scattered, swarming fish. Sacia Senecio, they say that when Plato took Timotheus, the son of Cannon, away from lavish, general-style banquets and entertained him at the academy simply and tastefully, with, as Ion puts it, tables that cause no inflammation, tables after which follow pure sleep and dreams of brief, untroubled visions, since the body enjoys fair weather and calm, Timotheus, noticing the difference the next day, remarked that those who had dined with Plato also felt well the day after. And indeed a well-tempered body, unburdened and light, standing ready without misgiving for every activity, is truly a great asset for having a good day. But those who dined with Plato gained something else no less valuable, the chance to go back over what had been said at the table. For the pleasures of what was drunk or eaten leave behind a memory that is ignoble, and besides, quick to fade, like a stale, greasy smell that lingers on. But the subject matter of philosophical problems and discussions delights those who remember it, ever present as though freshly given, and offers no less of a feast to those who were absent, once they hear of it and share in it from others. So much so that even now lovers of learning share in and enjoy the Socratic symposia, just as those who actually dined there did at the time. And yet, if it were bodily pleasures that mattered, Xenophon and Plato ought to have left behind, not a record of what was said, but an inventory of the dishes, cakes, and desserts served at the houses of Callias and Agathon. As it is, however, those things, though no doubt prepared at great trouble and expense, were never thought worthy of a single mention. Whereas the philosophical discussions carried on in a spirit of playful seriousness, they took care to set down in writing, leaving behind examples that show men ought not only to converse with one another over wine, but also to remember what was said. So I am sending you this sixth book of the Table Talk, in which the first question concerns why those who fast feel thirst more than hunger. It seemed unreasonable that those completing a fast should be thirstier than hungry, since the lack of solid food would seem naturally to call for its own proper replenishment. I said to those present that, of the things within us, it is heat that either alone, or more than anything else, requires nourishment. Just as, indeed, we observe that outside us neither air, water, nor earth desires to be fed or consumes what comes near it, but fire alone does. That is also why the young are more inclined to eat than the old, on account of their heat, while conversely the old bear fasting most easily, since in them the heat is already dulled and diminished, as in bloodless creatures, which likewise need food least of all because of their lack of heat. And each person individually finds that exercise, shouting, and whatever else increases heat through movement. Increases the heat, makes one eat more pleasantly and more eagerly. And food for the heat, as I think, that which is primary by nature, is above all the moist, as both the flames that grow when fed with oil show, and the fact that ash is the driest of all things. For the moisture has been burned out of it, and the earthy part is left bereft of moisture. And likewise fire separates and divides bodies by removing the moisture that binds and holds them together. So whenever we fast, the moisture is at first forcibly drawn off by the heat from the remnants of food in the body. Then the burning heat proceeds to the innate moisture of the flesh itself, pursuing the wet element. So, when a dryness comes about as in clay, the body naturally needs drink more, until, once we have drunk, the heat, restored and strengthened, produces an appetite for solid food. When this had been said, the physicians around Philo challenged the first thesis. They said that thirst does not arise from deficiency, but from a certain reshaping of the pores. For example, those who are thirsty at night, if they fall asleep, stop being thirsty without drinking, and those who have fevers when there is a remission or the fever has altogether ceased are at the same time freed from thirst. And for many people who have bathed, and by Zeus, for others who have vomited, thirst comes to an end. In none of these cases is the moisture increased. Rather, the pores alone are affected, undergoing some reshaping, a different arrangement and disposition. This becomes even clearer in the case of hunger. For many sick people are at once deficient and yet have no appetite, while for some others, even when they eat their fill, their appetites do not slacken at all, but instead intensify and persist. Indeed, many who had lost their appetite for food, on taking a salted olive or tasting a caper, quickly recovered and restored their appetite. From this, it is especially clear that hunger arises in us from some affection of the pores, not from deficiency. For such foods, though they add nourishment, and so reduce the deficiency, nevertheless produce hunger. In this way, the pleasant tastes and pungencies of relish foods, by contracting and tightening the stomach, or conversely by opening and relaxing it, work up around it a certain receptive fitness for food, which we call appetite. Now it seemed to me that these arguments had been made plausibly, but that they were opposed to the greatest end of nature, toward which appetite leads every living creature, namely desiring the replenishment of what is deficient and ever pursuing what is lacking of its own proper substance. For to deny that the very feature by which a living creature differs most from a lifeless thing exists in us for the sake of self-preservation and continuance, as an eye implanted for the things proper and necessary to the body, and instead to suppose that it is merely an affection and a kind of turning of the pores occurring through largeness and smallness, was, to my mind, an account that made no sense at all for those who posit nature so simply. Moreover, it is unreasonable that the body should shiver from a deficiency of its own proper heat, and yet no longer be thirsty or hungry from a deficiency of the natural moisture and nourishment. And it is even more unreasonable still, if nature desires emptying for the sake of filling, but does not desire filling for the sake of emptying, but rather because some other affection has arisen. And indeed, such needs and replenishments in the case of living creatures differ in no way from what happens in agriculture. For plants suffer many similar things and are helped in similar ways. Against dryness, they are watered by irrigation and cooled moderately when they are scorched. When they are chilled, we try to warm them and cover them, wrapping them in many coverings. And for whatever is not in our own power, we pray the God to grant it, soft dews and warm airs amid moderate breezes, so that nature may always have a replenishment for what is lacking, preserving its proper balance. For this is, I think, why nourishment, trough, was so named, that which preserves terrae nature. For plants, this preservation happens without sensation, drawn from their surrounding environment, as Empedocles says, as they are watered with what suits them. But in our case, appetite teaches us to seek and pursue what is lacking to our proper balance. Nevertheless, let us also examine each of the things said and show that it is not true. For foods with a pleasant taste and pungency perhaps produce, not appetite, but a kind of biting sensation in the parts that receive nourishment, like an itch from the touch of things that scratch. And even if this affection too is a form of appetite, it is likely that what is already present is broken down and separated by such foods as they become finer, and that they produce a deficiency, not because the pores are reshaped, but because they are emptied and cleared out. For sharp, pungent, and salty things break up the material and disperse and scatter it, so that they renew the appetite by squeezing out what is stale and left over from the day before. And in the case of those who bathe, it is not by being reshaped that the pores put an end to thirst, but by taking up moisture through the flesh and being filled with a moist vapor. As for vomiting, by expelling what is foreign, it affords nature the enjoyment of what is proper to it. For thirst is not simply for moisture, but for the moisture that is natural and proper to us. Hence, even if a great deal of foreign matter is present, a person remains in deficiency. For it stands in the way of the natural moisture, which is what appetite is for, and does not allow mixing or blending with it, until it withdraws and departs, and only then do the pores take up what is akin to them. Fevers, on the other hand, push the moisture into the depths, and when the middle parts of the body are inflamed, all the moisture has withdrawn there and is held compressed, which is why it happens that many people vomit at the same time, the density of the internal parts forcing the moisture upward, and are thirsty on account of the deficiency and dryness of the rest of the body. So whenever there is a remission, and the heat departs from the middle parts, the moisture, dispersing again, recedes and passing through, as is its nature, everywhere, both gives relief to the middle parts and softens the flesh, making it smooth and tender instead of rough and parched, and often also brings on sweats. Hence the deficiency that causes thirst ceases and comes to an end, as the moisture shifts away from the part that was overburdened and struggling to well up, toward the part that needs and desires it. For just as in a garden, when the well has an abundant supply of water, if no one draws it up and irrigates the plants, they must inevitably go thirsty and untended. So too in the body, when the moisture is dragged down into a single place, it is no wonder that there is deficiency and dryness in the rest, until there is once again an inflow and a diffusion, just as also happens with feverish patients, when their fever relaxes, and also happens to those who fall asleep while thirsty. For in their case too, sleep brings the moisture back from the middle parts and, distributing it everywhere among the parts, produces an equalizing and a replenishment. As for this so-called reshaping of the pores, by which hunger or thirst is said to arise, what sort of thing is it, really? For my part, I see no other differences that could occur in the pores, by way of affection, other than contracting and dilating. When they contract, they can receive neither drink nor food. And when they dilate, they create an emptiness and space, which is nothing but a deficiency of what is natural and proper. Indeed, my excellent friend, I said, the astringencies of the parts that are being dyed have a sharp, cleansing quality, by which, as the superfluous matter is excreted and dissolved away, the pores receive and retain more of the dye, taking it in because of their deficiency and emptiness. When this had been said, our host said that this too was reasonably argued, and turned to the further difficulty. The emptyings and refillings of the pores explain the immediate case well enough, but for those who are thirsty, the opposite happens. If they eat, it turns out that their thirst is intensified. This affection, he said, those who posit differing kinds of pores seem to him to explain most easily and most persuasively, even if their other points were argued only plausibly. For since there are pores in everyone, one pore has one set of proportions and another has another. Of these, the wider ones take up both dry and moist food together, while the narrower ones admit only drink. And the emptying of the narrower ones produces thirst, while that of the wider ones produces hunger. Hence, if those who are thirsty eat, they are not helped, since the pores, because of their narrowness, do not receive the dry food, but remain deficient in what is proper to them. while if those who are hungry drink, the liquids enter into the wider pores and, filling their emptiness, relax the excessive intensity of their hunger. To me, what actually happened seemed true, but I did not accept the hypothesis about its cause. "For indeed," I said, "if one were to riddle the flesh with these pores that some people are so attached to and fond of, one would make it flabby, tremulous, and unsound. And the notion that the same parts of the body do not receive drink and solid food alike, but that they trickle down and are sorted out as though through sieves, is altogether fanciful and bizarre. For this mixing with moisture, breaking down the food and taking the internal heat and the breath as its helpers, refines the nourishment more precisely than any instrument, with every kind of cutting and division, so that every particle of it becomes friendly and akin to every other particle, not fitted together as into vessels and holes, but unified and grown into one. And apart from these considerations, the greatest part of the difficulty has not even been resolved. For those who eat, if they do not also drink, not only fail to relieve their thirst, but actually intensify it further. And to this point, nothing has been said in reply. Consider then also our own account, I said, whether we are taking plausible hypotheses first, taking it that the moist is destroyed and used up by the dry, while the dry, moistened and softened by the moist, undergoes diffusions and exhalations. And second, not supposing that hunger is simply a squeezing out of dry food, nor thirst of moist food, but rather a deficiency of the moderate and sufficient amount. For those in whom either is entirely lacking altogether neither hunger nor thirst, but die at once. Once these premises are laid down, it is no longer difficult to grasp the cause. For thirst is intensified in those who have eaten, since the food, by its dryness, gathers up and draws out further whatever scattered moisture is left, weak and scanty, in the body. Just as, outside, we see earth, dust, and sand taken to themselves and make disappear whatever moisture is mixed with them. And drink, in turn, of necessity relieves hunger, for the moisture, wetting and dissolving the hard and gluey food already present, so that juices and vapors arise, carries these up into the body and adds them to the parts that need them. Hence, Erasistratus was not wrong to call the moist the vehicle of nourishment. For by mixing with what has become sluggish and heavy through dryness or some affection, it carries it up and lifts it along with itself. Many people, too, without drinking but only by bathing, have stopped being intensely and severely hungry. For the moisture entering from outside makes the food already present richer in juice and more nourishing, by loosening the internal parts, so that the intense bitterness and savagery of hunger relents and is soothed. This is also why some who are starving themselves deliberately live for a long time, provided they take only water, until every bit of what is capable of nourishing and being added to the body has been drawn out. For a luxury-loving foreign guest who liked his drinks cold, the servants prepared well water made colder still. For having drawn it up in a vessel and hung the vessel in the well, without letting it touch the spring, they let it spend the night there, and it was brought to dinner colder than freshly drawn water. The guest happened to be reasonably fond of learning, and said he had gotten this practice from Aristotle, set down along with an explanation. And the explanation was this: all water, once it has first been heated, cools all the more afterward, just like the water prepared for kings. For when it is boiled to the point of seething, they heap a great deal of snow around the vessel, and it becomes colder. Just as, of course, our own bodies too are cooled all the more after bathing, for the relaxation produced by the heat, having made the body full of open pores and porous, admits a great deal of the outside air and makes the change more violent. So, when the water is first given a preliminary chill by the spring, and then, in the air, warmed beforehand, it is cooled quickly afterward. Now we praise the guest for having remembered this so manfully, but about the explanation itself we were at a loss. For the air in which the vessel hangs, if it is cold, how does it warm the water? And if it is warm, how does it in turn cool it? For it is unreasonable for the same thing to suffer opposite effects from the same agent, with no difference having arisen. When he fell silent and was at a loss, I said there was no need to be puzzled about the air, for our senses tell us that it is cold, especially the air of deep wells, so that it is impossible for the water to be warmed by cold air. Rather, this cold air is unable to change the spring water because of its great quantity, But if one draws it off little by little, the air, gaining the upper hand, will cool it further. But surely, I said, as for the pebbles or the anvils, which people throw into water because they think this cools and tempers it, you recall that this too is stated by Aristotle. That, he said, is exactly the point. He has stated only the fact itself in his problems, that this is what happens, but as for the cause, we shall attempt it ourselves, for it is especially hard to discern. Quite so, I said, and indeed I would be surprised if the explanation did not escape us, but look at it all the same. First, does it not seem to you that the water is cooled by the air falling upon it from outside, and that the air acts more forcefully when it presses back against the stones and anvils? For these do not let it pass through, as bronze and earthenware vessels do, but by their density they hold it in and reflect it back from themselves into the water, so that the cooling becomes strong and thorough throughout. That is also why, in winter, rivers become colder than the sea. For in rivers the cold air, being reflected back, has force, whereas in the sea, because of its depth, it dissipates, having nothing to press back against. And in another way, too, it is likely that the thinner kinds of water are cooled all the more by the cold, since, being weaker, they are more easily overpowered by it. Now whetstones and pebbles make the water finer, by gathering together whatever muddy and earthy matter is mixed into it and drawing it down out of it, so that the water, becoming thinner and weaker, is more easily overpowered by the cooling. And indeed lead, too, is among the things that are naturally cold, since, when rubbed with vinegar, it releases white lead, the coldest of deadly poisons, and pebbles, by their density, carry the cold through to the depths. For every stone is a mass of earth that has been chilled and compacted by frost, the more compressed, the more so. So it is not absurd that both the stone and the lead, by resisting, intensify the coldness of the water. After a brief pause, the stranger said, "Lovers desire most of all to be with their darlings themselves, but failing that, they desire to talk about them, and this is what I feel about snow. Since it is not here with us and we do not have any, I should like to learn the reason why it is preserved by the very hottest things. For by wrapping it in chaff and swaddling it in unfold cloaks, people keep it undamaged for a long time. It is a marvel, then, if the hottest things are what preserve the coldest." "Quite so," I said, "if indeed it is true. But it is not so, rather we are deceiving ourselves, supposing that whatever warms is itself hot. We see that the very same cloak warms in winter and cools in summer, just as that tragic nurse tends the children of Niobe, warming and cooling them with the tatters of finely woven mantles. The Germans, at any rate, use clothing as a defense against cold alone, the Ethiopians against heat alone, but we use it against both. So why, if it warms, should we call it hot rather than cold on the ground that it cools? If we must judge by sensation, it would rather be called cold. For the tunic strikes us as cold when we first put it on, and so do the bedclothes when we lie down. But then it grows warm as it is filled with the heat coming from us, at once enclosing and holding in the heat, and at the same time keeping out the cold and outside air away from the body. Thus people who are feverish and burning up constantly change their clothes, because whatever is put on them feels cold. Yet once it has been put on, it at once becomes hot from the body's heat. So then, just as the cloak, once warmed, warms us, so once chilled, it in turn chills the snow. And it is chilled by the fine vapor the snow gives off. For it is this, shut up within, that holds together the snow's congealed state. And when the vapor departs, the snow, being water, flows and melts away, and the whiteness, which the mixture of vapor with moisture, becoming frothy, had produced, fades. At the same time, then, the cold is held in, roofed over by the cloak, and the outside air, being shut out, neither cuts into the mass of ice nor lets it dissipate. Unfold cloaks serve this purpose especially well because of their roughness and dryness. The nap of their wool does not let the heavy cloak press down and crush the looseness of the snow. Just as chaff, too, because of its lightness, falls upon it softly and does not break up the mass of ice, while otherwise being dense and close-packed enough to keep out the heat of the air and to prevent the cold from leaving the snow. That the escape of the vapor is what causes the melting is evident to the senses, for as the snow melts it produces vapor. Nigris, our fellow citizen, had come back from his studies, having spent no long time in the company of a distinguished philosopher, but long enough that, without grasping the man's real teaching, he had become filled with its more tiresome features. Imitating his master's fault-finding manner and cross-examining his companions on every subject. So when Aristion was giving us a dinner, Nigris found fault with the rest of the provisions as extravagant and overlaborate, and said that wine ought not to be poured out strained, but, as Hesiod bade, should be drunk straight from the jar, keeping its natural strength and power. Such straining, he said, first of all cuts out its sinews and quenches its heat, since it often blooms and breathes itself away in the straining. And second, it displays fussiness and affectation, and a luxury that squanders what is useful for the sake of what is pleasant. For just as the practice of castrating cocks and pigs, making their flesh soft and womanish contrary to nature, belongs not to healthy people but to those corrupted by gluttony. So too, if I may use a metaphor, those who strain the unmixed wine emasculate it and make it effeminate, being unable, through weakness, either to carry its strength or to drink a moderate amount, because of their own intemperance. Rather, this is a device and a contrivance of theirs for drinking more. They remove the wine's weight and leave only its smoothness, just as people give boiled down wine to invalids who crave cold drinks uncontrollably. Whatever gives wine its temper and strength, this they remove and strip away in the straining. A strong proof of this is its spoiling, the fact that it does not keep, but degenerates and wastes away, as if cut off from its root, the lees. The ancients, indeed, called wine outright by the name lees, just as we are accustomed to call a man's soul or head, naming him from his most essential part. And we speak of those who gather the vintage of the vine as lees gathering. And Homer somewhere used the word vintage time. And he was accustomed to call wine itself gleaming and red, not, as Aristion gives it to us, pale and sallow through excessive straining. Aristion laughed and said, "No, my friend, not pale nor bloodless, but mild and gentle to judge from its very look, for a start. You, though, insist on gorging yourself on the night-black, dark-robed wine, and you fault the straining as if it were a bilious vomiting, through which the wine, releasing what is heavy, intoxicating, and unwholesome, becomes light and mixes with us without violence. The very wine, I think, that Homer says the heroes drink. For he does not call gleaming what is murky, but what is clear and bright. The poet who spoke of bronze as man-strengthening and gleaming would not have called it gleaming if it were dark. So then, just as the wise Anacharsis, while finding fault with other things among the Greeks, praised the charcoal burners because they leave the smoke outside and bring fire home, so you wise men would do better to find fault with other things. If we push out and disperse the wine's disturbing and troublesome element, delighting in the wine itself without predifying it, and without cutting off its temper and edge as one would irons, but rather cleansing it as one would rust or grime, in what way do we go wrong? Because, by Zeus, it is stronger when unstrained. But a man too, my friend, when delirious and raving is stronger too. But when, by the use of hellebore or a regimen, he is brought back to health, that violent, high-strung force departs and fades away, and true strength and soundness of mind come to his body. So too, the straining of wine, by removing its harsh, maddening quality, brings it into a gentle and healthy condition. Overlaborateness, I think, differs very greatly from cleanliness, for women who rouge themselves, perfume themselves, and wear gold and purple seem overlaborate, but no one finds fault with bathing, anointing, or arranging one's hair. The poet delightfully shows the difference in the passage where Hera adorns herself. First with ambrosia, she cleansed every stain from her immortal skin and anointed herself richly with oil. Up to this point, it is simply care and cleanliness. But when she takes up the golden pins and the earrings wrought with such fine skill, and finally, at the end, takes hold of the sorcery that is in the girdle, the matter becomes overlaborateness and a wantonness unbefitting a wife. So too with wine. Those who tint it with aloes or sweeten it with cinnamon and saffron are dressing it up like a woman and pimping it out for the symposia. But those who remove from it what is foul and useless are tending and cleansing it. Otherwise, you might call all these things overlaborateness, beginning with the house itself. Why is it so carefully plastered? Why is it opened up on the side from which it will best receive clean air and enjoy the light as it moves around toward its setting? Why is every cup polished and scoured all over so as to shine and glitter? Or was the cup meant to be free of filth and rancid smells, while what is drunk from it is to be full of mold or stains, and why need I mention other things? For the very working of wheat into bread is nothing other than a process of purification. See with how much labor it is carried out. It is not merely a matter of sifting, sieving, separating, and distinguishing the grain from what does not belong to it, but the kneading, which presses out the roughness of the dough, and the baking, which draws off the moisture, purify and reduce the matter down to what is edible alone. What then is strange if straining likewise removes the lees of wine, as one would coarse meal or refuse, especially since this purification requires neither expense nor much trouble? There is an ancestral sacrifice which the Archon performs at the public hearth, while each of the others performs it privately at home. It is called the driving out of Bulimos. They strike one of the household slaves with rods of the chase tree and drive him out through the doors, saying as they do so, "Out with Bulimos, in with wealth and health." Now when I was serving as Archon, a good many people took part with me in the sacrifice. And when we had performed the customary rites and reclined again at table, the discussion first turned on the name itself, then on the formula they pronounce over the one being driven out, but above all on the affliction and what accompanies it. It seemed that Bulimos signifies a great or public famine, especially among us Aeolians, who use pie in place of beta. For we do not say Bulimos but Pulimos, as though it were a great hunger, Polly's limos. And it seemed that Baubrastes was something different. We took our evidence for this from Metrodorus' Ionian history, for he records that the Smyonians, who were formerly Aeolians, sacrifice a black bull to Baubrastes, cutting it up and burning it whole, hide and all. And since all hunger seems akin to disease, and Bulimos especially so, arising when the body has suffered something contrary to its nature, they reasonably set wealth in opposition to it as to a deficiency, and health as to a disease, just as to be seasick was originally named for those whose stomachs grow weak on board ship and during a voyage, but through common usage has come to be the name of the affliction for anyone who suffers it in any way whatsoever. So too, it seems. To be ravenously hungry, bulimen, beginning from that origin, has extended its meaning to this case. These points, then, we all filled out together as a shared contribution of remarks. But when we came to grips with the cause of the affliction, the first question raised was why those who travel through deep snow become especially ravenous, as indeed Brutus, going from Dyrrhachium toward Apollonia, was endangered by this affliction. There was a heavy snowfall, and none of those carrying provisions kept up with him. So when he began to faint and collapse, his soldiers were forced to run up to the city walls and beg bread from the enemy sentries guarding them. And having received it, they at once revived Brutus, which is why, when he later became master of the city, he treated everyone with kindness. Horses and donkeys suffer this affliction too, especially when they are carrying dried figs or apples. And what is most remarkable is that bread, more than any other food, restores not only men but also pack animals, so that even if they eat the smallest amount of it, they are cured and can walk again. When silence fell, reflecting that the arguments of our elders, while they set at rest and satisfy the lazy and untalented, give the ambitious and learned a starting point of their own and the boldness to seek out and track down the truth, I recalled the Aristotelian treatises, in which it is said that, when there is great chilling from outside, the internal parts become intensely heated and produce a great deal of melting matter. And this, if it flows down into the legs, produces fatigue and heaviness, but if it flows to the sources of movement and respiration, produces faintness or even weakness. When this argument had been stated, what naturally followed took place. Some attacked the doctrine, others defended it vigorously. Sokal said that the starting point of the argument was very well laid down. For the bodies of those who walk through snow are indeed sufficiently chilled and compacted, but that the melting matter produces heat, and that this heat then takes hold of the sources of respiration, seemed to him to beg the question. He thought it more likely that the heat, being contracted and increased within, consumes the body's nourishment, and then, once this too runs short, dies down like a fire, itself fading away. That is why such travelers grow extremely hungry, and on eating even a very small amount, immediately flare up again, for what is eaten becomes, as it were, fuel to kindle the heat anew. Cleomenes the physician, however, said that the word hunger, Limos is bound up in the name quite apart from the actual thing, just as drinking is contained in swallowing, and bending in straightening up. For bulimia, he said, is not really hunger as it seems, but an affection in the stomach that produces faintness through a rush of heat. So just as things with a strong smell help against fainting fits, so bread revives those who are ravenous, not because they lack nourishment, since they revive at once on receiving even the smallest amount, but because it calls back the breath and strength that are sinking away. That it is faintness and not hunger is shown by the case of pack animals. For carrying dried figs or apples does not create any deficiency, but rather a kind of heartburn and, by Zeus, a sort of dizziness. To us, however, this too seemed to be said only in a moderate degree, and it seemed possible, starting from the opposite premise, positing not compression but rarefaction, to preserve the plausibility of the explanation. For the vapor that flows off from snow is, as it were, the finest chaff of the frozen mass, an extremely fine-grained powder. Yet it has a certain cutting, dividing power, not only on flesh but even on silver and bronze vessels. For we see that these do not hold the snow in. As it evaporates, it is used up, and it fills the outer surface of the vessel with a thin, crystal-like moisture, which the vapor leaves behind as it departs imperceptibly through the pores. This same vapor, striking those who walk through snow as something sharp and flame-like, seems to burn their extremities by cutting into and passing through the flesh, just like fire. Hence a great rarefaction occurs throughout the body, and the heat flows outward because of the coldness of the vapor, and, being quenched near the surface, it dissipates as a fine, dewy sweat, so that the body's strength melts away and is used up. Now if a person keeps still, not much heat leaves the body. But when movement quickly converts the body's nourishment into heat, while the heat is carried outward, and the flesh is broken down, a sudden failure of strength is bound to occur. That being chilled not only congeals, but also melts bodies is clear. For in great winters whetstones of lead melt away. And both the sweating that occurs and the fact that ravenous hunger befalls many who are not even hungry point rather to a rarefaction and a flowing away than to a compaction of the body. Bodies are rarefied, and in winter, as has been said, it is by the thinness of the breath. But otherwise it is fatigue and motion that sharpen the heat within the body. For having become thin and wearied, it flows out abundantly and is dispersed through the body. It is likely that apples and dried figs breathe out something of this kind, so that they refine and break up the heat of pack animals, for different things are naturally suited to be absorbed and dissolved by different agents. The question was once raised why, although there are many liquids, the poet is accustomed to adorn the rest with their own particular epithets. Calling milk white, honey pale green, and wine red, yet he calls oil merely moist, fittingly, from the quality common to all liquids alone. The answer given was that, just as the sweetest thing is that which is sweet all the way through, and the whitest that which is white all the way through, so too a thing is called moist in the fullest sense when nothing in it is dry. And this is the case with oil. In the first place, its smoothness displays the uniformity of its parts, for it is consistent with itself all the way through, in respect of touch. Next, it offers the clearest surface for the sight to mirror itself in, for there is nothing rough in it to break up the reflection, but from every part, because of its liquidity, it bends back even the smallest ray of light onto the eye. Just the opposite of milk, which of all liquids alone does not reflect, because of the great deal of earthy matter mixed into it. Further, when stirred, it makes the least noise of all liquids, for it is liquid all the way through, whereas in the others, as they flow and are carried along, the hard and earthy particles knock and strike against each other and make a noise because of their roughness. Moreover, it alone remains unmixed and undiluted, for it is the densest of liquids. It has no empty spaces or pores between its dry and earthy parts within itself to receive whatever is thrown in, but because of the likeness of its parts, it is well fitted together and continuous. And when the oil foams, it does not admit air, because of its fineness and continuity. This is also the reason why fire is nourished by it. For fire is nourished by nothing except what is moist, and this alone is combustible. From wood, at any rate, the airy part departs as smoke, while the earthy part is left behind reduced to ash, Only the moist part is consumed by the fire, for by this it is naturally nourished. Water, then, and wine, and the rest, since they share largely in what is turbid and earthy, when they fall upon the flame, tear it apart both by their roughness and by their weight, pressing it down and quenching it. But oil, because it is most purely liquid, changes because of its fineness, and once overcome, catches fire. The greatest proof of its liquidity is the fact that from the smallest quantity it spreads and diffuses over the largest area. For neither honey nor water nor any other liquid, however small a quantity, undergoes such an expansion, but is quickly used up and exhausted because of its dryness. Oil, however, being everywhere pliable and soft, spreads over the body of those anointed with it and flows along together with them to the greatest distance, because of the liquidity by which its parts are drawn out, so that it also remains and is hard to wash out. A garment soaked with water dries easily, but to clean out stains of oil is no ordinary task, for it penetrates most of all because it is the finest and most liquid of things. And indeed people find it harder to get diluted wine out of garments, as Aristotle says, because it is finer and penetrates more into the pores. Aristion's cook was in high favor among the diners, since, besides preparing the rest of the meal skillfully, he served up a cock that had just been sacrificed to Heracles, tender as if it had been killed the day before, though it was in fact fresh and newly slaughtered. When Aristion said that this happens quickly if the bird, as soon as it is killed, is hung from a fig tree, we sought the reason. That a strong and violent vapor issues from the fig tree is attested both by observation and by what is said about bulls. That the fiercest bull, when tied to a fig tree, grows calm and submits to being touched, and altogether lets go of its rage as though it were being worn away. But the greatest part of the cause and power lay in the pungency. For the fig tree is the most acrid-sapped of all plants, so that the fig itself, the wood, and the leaf are all saturated with it. Hence, when burned, its smoke stings especially sharply, and its ash, once burnt, produces a very cleansing powder, and all of this is due to heat. Some think that the sap causes milk to curdle, not by entangling and gluing together the particles of the milk, through the unevenness of their shapes, with the smooth and rounded ones being squeezed out to the surface, but rather by melting away, through heat, the unstable and watery part of the liquid. Evidence of this is also the fact that the sap, useless as it is sweet, yet is the worst of drinks. For it is not the smooth parts that are separated out by the uneven ones, but rather the cold and unconcocted part that is halted by the heat. Salt, too, contributes to this effect, for it is hot, but against the supposed entangling and binding, it works in the opposite direction, since salt is by nature especially apt to dissolve things. So then the fig tree gives off a hot, pungent, and cutting vapor, and this it is that breaks down and ripens the flesh of the bird. The same thing happens when wheat is placed in a pit together with nitre, on account of heat. That the fig has something hot in it, they infer from the wine jars. When these are placed in a storage pit, the wine in them is quickly used up. There is a saying current among the Romans, Sosius Senecio, that they attribute to a witty and kindly man, who, when he had dined alone, said he had eaten, not dined, that day, as though he always longed for the fellowship and friendliness that sweeten a dinner. Evenus used to say that fire is the most pleasant of seasonings, and Homer calls salt divine, while most people call it the graces, because, being mixed into most things, it makes them agreeable and pleasant and welcome to the taste. But of a dinner and a table, the truly most divine seasoning is a friend who is present, familiar, and well known, not because he eats and drinks together with the company, but because he shares in and imparts conversation, provided there is in it something useful, persuasive, and suited to what is being said. Since for most people idle chatter over wine drives them, in their foolishness, into their passions, and further distorts them. For this reason, it is worth taking no less care in choosing our topics of conversation than our friends when we invite them to dinner, holding the opposite view and practice from the Spartans. For they, when they admit a young man or a stranger to their common mess, point to the windows and say, "Through here no word goes out." We, on the other hand, accustom ourselves to use words that can be carried out to everyone and shared with all, because our subjects contain nothing licentious or blasphemous or malicious or ungenerous. One may judge from the examples, of which this book contains the 7th set of 10. It happened once in summer that one of the guests came out with the ready-made line that everyone uses, "Soak your lungs with wine, for the star is rising again." And Nicias of Nicopolis, the physician, said, "It is no wonder if a poet like Alcaeus was ignorant of something that even Plato the philosopher was ignorant of." And yet Alcaeus might somehow find some support in that the lung, being near the stomach, does enjoy some of its moisture, and so it is plausible that it is dampened on that account. But the philosopher, he said, after writing so clearly that drinks pass through the lung, has left even his most eager defenders no plausible line of defense on his behalf. For the misapprehension is a great one. In the first place, since the passage of moist food needs to be mixed with the dry, it is likely that the same vessel underlies both, namely the gullet, which delivers the food, softened and soaked, into the stomach below. And again, since the lung has become altogether smooth and dense, how does the barley meal drunk in a posset pass through it without being caught? This is the very difficulty that Erasistratus rightly raised against him. And indeed, in the case of most of the parts of the body, he continued, Plato, in tracing through his argument the purpose for which each part exists, and wishing to understand the use for which nature made each one, as indeed befits a philosopher to think, does not properly account for the function of the epiglottis, which is appointed for this very purpose. That in the swallowing of food it should press upon the windpipe and prevent anything at all from slipping into the lung. For terrible are the roughnesses and lacerations produced by coughing, when something slips past and the breath is driven out. And this structure, lying between the two passages and inclining toward each, falls upon the gullet when we speak, and upon the windpipe when we eat and drink, keeping the course clear for the breath and for respiration. Further, he said, we know that those who drink gently keep their bellies moister than those who gulp down liquid all at once. For the gulped liquid is at once driven, by its own force, straight into the bladder, whereas liquid drunk gently lingers longer among the food and softens it, so that it becomes mingled with it and remains. This would not happen if the liquids were separated off immediately upon swallowing, and did not rather become entangled with us and escort the food along together, using the liquid as a kind of vehicle, as Erasistratus used to say. While Nicias was expounding these matters, Protogenes the grammarian said that he had observed that Homer, before anyone else, understood that the gullet is the vessel of food, and the windpipe that of breath, which the ancients called the asphagus. Hence they were accustomed to call men with loud voices Erasphagoi. For having said that Achilles struck Hector's throat where death of the soul comes swiftest, he adds, nor did the bronze-heavy ash spear cut through the windpipe, so that he might yet address him in reply with words. As if the windpipe were the proper channel of voice and breath, while he had set down the throat separately as the passage for the other. When silence fell upon this speech, Flora said, shall we let Plato go by default, with no one to defend him? Not we, I said. For if we abandon Plato, we shall at the same time have to abandon Homer along with him, who is so far from driving liquid away and turning it aside from the windpipe that he even has the food expelled together with it in that very passage. For he says, wine gushed out from his throat and gobbets of human flesh. Unless one is to say that the Cyclops, just as he had a single eye, also had a single passage, the same for both food and voice, or that the word he uses, pharynx, means the gullet and not the windpipe, contrary to the way it has always been used by everyone, both long ago and now. I have brought these points forward not for lack of witnesses, but because truth itself led me to them, since indeed many good witnesses stand ready for Plato. Set aside, if you like, Eupolis, who in his flatterer says, for Protagoras used to bid us drink, so that our lung might be washed clean before the dog star rises. Set aside, too, the elegant Eratosthenes, who speaks of the lung, deep and moistened with unmixed wine. And Euripides, saying plainly, wine passing through the channels of the lungs, clearly shows himself to have seen something even sharper than Erasistratus. For he saw that the lung has cavities and is pierced through with pores, through which it lets moisture pass. For breath had no need of pores for its exit. Rather, the lung has become sieve-like and full of many passages for the sake of the liquids, and of whatever slips along together with liquids. And it is, my good man, no less fitting for the lung than for the gullet to pass along together with the drink the barley meal and the meal groats. Since our gullet, too, is not smooth, as some say, nor slippery, but has roughnesses, on which it is likely that the fine and small particles that come up against them and catch there escape the act of swallowing. But it is not right to say either the one thing or the other. For nature's ingenuity in matters of function is beyond the reach of argument, nor is it possible for reason to describe worthily the precision of the instruments she employs. I mean the breath and the heat. Further, among the witnesses I summon for Plato, Philistion of Locri, a very ancient man and one distinguished in your art, and Hippocrates, and Dioxippus the follower of Hippocrates. For these men set forth not some other path, but the very one that Plato pointed out for the drink. Indeed, the much-honored epiglottis did not escape the notice of Dioxippus, but he says that it is around this that the liquid, being separated off during swallowing, flows into the windpipe, while the food rolls on into the gullet. And that nothing of the food falls into the windpipe. But the gullet, along with the dry food, also receives a certain part of the liquid mixed in with it. For it is plausible that the epiglottis lies before the windpipe as a partition and a regulator, so that the drink may filter through gently and little by little, rather than the breath being forced and disturbed by it rushing in quickly and all at once. This is why birds have not developed and do not have an epiglottis, for they neither suck nor lap, but peck, letting the drink down little by little and gently moistening and wetting the windpipe. Enough, then, of witnesses. Plato's argument first has its warrant from observation itself. For when the windpipe is wounded, the liquid is not swallowed, but as when a channel is cut open, it is seen falling out and spurting forth, even though the gullet remains sound and uninjured. Next, we all know that in cases of lung disease, thirst follows, most intense, caused by dryness or by heat, or by some other cause that, together with the inflammation, produces the craving. And what is an even greater proof than this? Those animals in which no lung has grown, or in which only a very small one has grown, have no need of drink at all, nor do they desire it, because the desire for its proper function is inborn in each of the parts. And where there are no such parts, there is neither need nor eagerness for the activity performed through them. In general, the bladder would seem to have come into being for nothing in the case of those who have one. For if the gullet takes up the drink together with the food and hands it over to the belly, the residue of the liquid food needs no channel of its own, but a single common one suffices for both, as if by a shared conduit, brought in together by the same route to the same place. But as it is, separate has the bladder come to be, and separate the intestine. Because the one proceeds from the lung, the other from the gullet, the two being separated off at once during swallowing. Hence no trace of the dry residue appears in the liquid, resembling it neither in color nor at all in smell, although it would naturally have come to share in those qualities, had it been mixed and soaked together with it in the belly and not be strained out so pure and untainted. But no stone has ever formed in the stomach either. And yet, there was just as much reason for the liquid to congeal and solidify there as in the bladder, if indeed everything that is drunk passed into the stomach by way of the gullet. But it seems that the gullet, drawing off at once from the windpipe enough, and only a moderate amount of the passing liquid, uses it up for the softening and reducing of the food to chyle, and therefore produces no excess of liquid, while the lung, distributing from itself, as it were, both breath and moisture to the parts that need them, secretes the remainder into the bladder. These explanations are far more plausible than the others. Yet perhaps the truth in such matters is ungraspable, and one ought not, in a matter so obscure and so much disputed, be so dogmatic, especially not one who lays first claim to reputation and ability as a philosopher. In our readings of Plato, the terms horn-struck and unsoffenable always occasioned inquiry, not as to what they meant, for it was clear that, since people believed the seeds that struck against the horns of oxen produced unsoffenable fruit, they called a stubborn, hard man horn-struck and unsoffenable by the same metaphor. But the dispute was about the very cause itself, on account of which this happens to seeds that strike against the horns of oxen. And we often begged off from our friends, deterred not least by Theophrastus's discussion, in which he has collected and recorded many facts whose cause is undiscoverable by us, such as the scratching about of hens after they have laid, the seal that swallows its rennet when caught, the horn that the stag buries, and the oringo plant, which, when a single goat takes it into her mouth, brings the whole herd to a standstill. For among such cases, the horn striking of seeds, too, is commonly cited as a fact that commands belief, though its cause is either undiscoverable or exceedingly difficult. But once at Delphi, over dinner, some of our companions set upon us, arguing that not only does counsel and judgment grow better from a full stomach, but wine also makes our inquiries keener and our pronouncements bolder, and they asked me to say something about the problem. Now I had no poor advocates for declining, Euthydemus my fellow priest and Patrocles my son-in-law, who brought forward not a few facts of this kind, drawn from farming and hunting. It was thought, for instance, that hail is the sort of thing turned aside by hail watchers using the blood of a mole or women's rags, and that wild fig branches, tied onto cultivated fig trees, keep the fruit from falling and hold it together and help it ripen. And that deer, when caught, shed a salty tear, but pigs a sweet one. But if you go looking into these things, said Euthydemus, you will presently have to account for celery and cumin as well, the one people think grows better for being trampled and crushed underfoot as it sprouts, the other for being sown with curses and abuse. Since Florus thought this all play and nonsense, while none of the others would give up the inquiry as ungraspable, I said, I have found a remedy, with which, if you too will resolve some of the difficulties you have raised, you can press this argument home against me. It seems to me that cold produces hardness in wheat and chickpeas, compressing and congealing their substance to the point of hardness, while warmth makes them easily loosened and soft. Hence those are wrong who apply to such cases the Homeric line about the no-year bears fields. For naturally warm places, given a favorable blending of air, produce softer fruits. Now of the seeds that fall from the hand straight into the earth, those that sink in and are, so to speak, born under cover enjoy more fully the earth's warmth and moisture. But those that strike against the horns of oxen do not meet with the best good order, as Hesiod calls it, but being knocked aside and slipping off, resemble things thrown rather than things sown. Hence either the cold destroys them outright, or, striking their bare coats, makes them hard to dissolve, sapless, and woody. For you can see that even among stones, the parts embedded in earth as if alive are softer than those on the surface. Warmth keeps them so. That is why craftsmen bury the stones they mean to work, as if ripening them by warmth, while those left in the open air, bare, become resistant, hard to shape, and unsoftenable because of the cold. And they say that grain too, if it remains longer on the thrashing floor exposed and bare, becomes harder than grain gathered up at once. In some places, too, a wind that strikes the grain while it is being winnowed makes it hard because of the cold, as they report happens at Philippi in Macedonia. But chaff heaped over stored grain protects it. And one should not be surprised to hear farmers say that of two parallel furrows, one produces hard grain and the other soft. And, most remarkable of all, that of the pods of a single bean plant, some are of one sort and some of another, obviously because a cold wind or rain has struck some less and others more. Election, my father-in-law, made fun of Hesiod for advising us to drink freely at the opening and the closing of the jar, but be sparing in the middle, precisely where the best wine is found. For who, he said, does not know that the middle of wine is best, the top of oil and the bottom of honey? He ought rather to have told us to leave the wine in the middle alone and wait until it turns for the worse, once the jar has run low. When this had been said, we let Hesiod go and turned to inquiring into the cause of the difference. The matter of the honey gave us little trouble, since almost everyone knows that the lightest part is lightest because of its porousness, while the dense and continuous part settles below the rest by its weight. And if you turn the vessel upside down, each part in a little while resumes its proper place, one sinking, the other rising to the top. Nor was wine left without plausible explanations either. First, its potency, being a kind of heat, seems reasonably to be concentrated most in the middle, and this is best preserved there. And second, the lower part is spoiled by the lees, while the upper part on the surface is corrupted by the nearness of the air. For we know that air is most apt to alter the character of wine. That is why people bury the jars and cover them, so that as little air as possible may touch them. And most important of all, a full vessel does not let wine spoil as readily as one that has grown depleted, for a great deal of air flows in to fill the empty space and alters it all the more, whereas in full vessels the wine is held together by itself and admits little of the corrupting influence from outside. Oil, too, gave us no poor occasion for discussion. One person said that the lower part of the oil grows worse, being clouded by the sediment, and that the upper part is not really better but only seems so, because it is farthest from what harms it. Another blamed the density of oil, on account of which it is most resistant to mixture and admits none of the other liquids into itself, except when forced in by some blow. Hence it does not even mix with air, but keeps apart because of the fineness and continuity of its particles, so that it is changed less by air, since the air cannot master it. Aristotle seemed to oppose this account, having observed, as he says, that oil grows more fragrant and altogether better in vessels that have been partly emptied. He then assigns the cause of the improvement to the air, since there is more of it, and it prevails more as it settles into the depleted vessel. "Perhaps then," I said, "the air both benefits oil and harms wine by the very same power. For aging is advantageous to wine, but disadvantageous to oil, and the air, falling upon each, removes this aging. What is cooled stays fresh, while what has no outlet grows old quickly and withers through continuous confinement. So it has plausibly been said that the air, approaching what lies at the surface, keeps it fresh. That is why the top of wine is the worst part, and the top of oil the best, for aging produces the best condition in the one, the worst in the other. Florus, being fond of old customs, would not allow the table to be cleared bare, but always left some food remaining on it. And this is not the only thing," he said, "that I know my father and grandfather carefully observed. They also never let a lamp go out. For the ancient Romans were most scrupulous about this too, whereas people nowadays put it out right after dinner, so as not to waste oil needlessly." Eustrophus the Athenian, who was present, said, "Well, what more good does that do them, unless they also learn the clever trick of our friend Polycharmus, who said that after much deliberation over how the slaves might be kept from stealing the oil, he barely worked out the solution, to fill the lamps to the brim the moment they went out, and then check again the next day whether they remained full." Florus laughed and said, "Well then, since that problem is solved, let us examine the question why it is likely that the ancients were just as scrupulous about lamps as about tables." The question of the lamps was taken up first, and his son-in-law Caesarnius supposed that, because of its kinship with the undying, sacred fire, the elders regarded the destruction of any fire whatsoever as something to be religiously avoided. For there are two kinds of destruction, as with a human being, one violent, when the fire is put out by force, the other as if natural, when it wastes away of itself. The sacred fire, then, they guarded against both, continually feeding and watching it. But the other fire they let waste away of itself, without doing it violence or begrudging it, as though they were taking the life from a creature, so that it should not be kept alive to no purpose. Lucius, the son of Florus, said that the rest was well said, but that in singling out the sacred fire, they did not thereby honor and revere it as better or more solemn than other fire. Rather, just as some Egyptians revere and honor the whole race of dogs, others that of wolves or crocodiles, yet each people keeps and feeds only a single animal, some a dog, others a crocodile, others a wolf, since it was not possible to keep them all, so here too the care and guarding bestowed on that one fire was a symbol of scrupulous regard for fire in general. For nothing else so resembles a living thing as fire does moving and feeding itself, and by its brightness revealing all things and making them plain, as the soul does. And its power, not without a share in the vital principle, shows itself most of all in its quenching and destruction. For it cries out and makes sounds and resists, just as a living thing does when it is killed by violence, unless you have something better to say, he said, looking toward me. "None of the causes given," I said, "do I find fault with, but I would add that the custom is also a lesson in kindliness. For it is not right to destroy food when one has had one's fill, nor, after drinking deep from a spring, to blind and hide its source, nor to destroy the markers of a voyage or a road once one has made use of them, but to leave and preserve what is useful for those who will need it after us. Hence, it is not honorable, out of stinginess, to extinguish the light of a lamp we no longer need, but rather to preserve and leave it, in case someone in need should come while it is still there and burning. For indeed, if it were possible, it would be a fine thing to lend even sight and hearing to another. And, by Zeus, prudence and courage too, when we ourselves are about to sleep and rest. Consider, too, whether it was not from a similar training in gratitude, carried to an extreme, that the ancients revered fruit-bearing oaks, and the Athenians called a certain fig tree sacred and forbade the felling of the sacred olive. For such practices do not, as some say, incline men toward superstition, but accustom our sense of gratitude and fellow feeling, even in our dealings with insensate and inanimate things. Hence Hesiod rightly does not allow food to be served from pots that have not first been offered to the fire, but bids us render the fire its first fruits and its due honor for its service. And the Romans did well in their use of lamps, in that they did not take back the nourishment they had given, but let it be used and let it shine as long as it lived. When I had said this, Eustrophus said, "Does this, then, also give a fitting opening to the discussion of the table, for one who thinks that something should always be left over from dinner for the servants and the servants' children?"